What is going on, everybody? Sorry, we don't have any video tonight. My internet's acting pretty weird, so we're just doing regular, old school, just audio. It's like the old school radio days, you know. I actually used to do podcasts like this for quite a few years with just audio, so it's going to be kind of a throwback thing for me. It's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be like, you know, welcome to WBOG Radio. Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool. So we're going to go back to those kind of days. But with me, I have everybody's favorite southern gentleman, Mr. Folkish Farmer, riding shotgun with me. Mr. Tristan is off tonight. How are we doing tonight, Mr. Folkish Farmer?
Excellent. How are you guys doing? I hope surviving the corona apocalypse.
Oh, yeah. And we're going to chat about that a little bit today, too. But with us tonight to talk about his newly released book, Slavic Paganism for Beginners, we have the very eccentric, very interesting, back to the program, Mr. Dmitry Kushner. Privyet, comrade.
Yeah, good to be here.
How was my Russian there? Did I sound like a Russian?
You sounded a little rough and angry.
That's all right. I thought Russians were rough and angry.
Not really.
No, all right. Well, so, Mr. Dmitry, let's get right into it. Mr. Dmitry produced, he wrote this book, he published it, and he sent me a copy as a gift, and I really appreciated it, and it was a really smooth read. I actually sat down, read it in like a little over an hour. I read through it, and I enjoyed reading it, and there's quite a few topics in here that I can't wait to dig into with Mr. Dmitry, and there's actually a few things I disagree with that I think we're going to debate on, but that's always fun, that's always good, it's always positive in our community to have open debates like that. But Mr. Dmitry, before we get started, tell us, why did you write this book? How long did it take you? Just tell us about your process, and you've written quite a few books. How many books have you written?
As of right now, I think my count is up to like 46.
46 books.
And currently I'm working on Slavic Paganism for Beginners, Book 2. And actually, you served as a motivation for that, because the last show we did, basically the questions I hear them all the time. So I just decided to put them in the book and answer them the best I can.
That's awesome. Well, I'm glad I could be an inspiration like that.
Yeah, it took me actually, it was rather easy write. It took me about 2 days to write it.
So, you said number 47. Do you even remember how many, like, the titles do all your books?
If I have to think about it, I'm sure I can remember all of the titles. I probably will not remember everything that's in every book, but I will definitely remember all the titles.
Yeah, I wrote one book and I can't even remember what's in it. So I'm just joking, by the way. I do remember what's in it. I'm not that bad. But so let's get right into Slavic Paganism for Beginners. So you go over about kind of the base principles, kind of like the foundations of what Slavic Paganism is, or at least your take on your interpretation of what Slavic Paganism is, because I know that you're really heavy on personal interpretation and stuff like that. So you're not quite in the kind of thought process that a lot of us, like the Sedians, are, which we believe very heavily in codification and quantifying things and having, you know, academic methods and stuff. Like, you are very much from the heart kind of guy, old knowledge, you know, folk memory, tapping into that kind of stuff. So you go through all the basic foundational principles of your interpretation of Slavic paganism. What were kind of like the core parts that you wanted to hit? I know you named the deities, you talk about the concept of worship, the creation, sin, and you go through did you have like an outline of what principles you wanted to hit before you wrote it, or did you kind of just open it up and start writing?
I usually just start writing because, as you said, I tap into the ancestral memory. And when I speak or when I write, especially when I answer questions, very often I really don't know what to say because it's kind of like my ancestors are speaking through me. So it's impossible to have an outline. All I did was took out the single sheet of paper, wrote down the questions, and then took my time to answer each one of those questions. Like beforehand, I had no clue what the answers would be.
Yeah. And this kind of, you know, I believe just about every chapter is a question, like a one chapter two. How many deities are there? And you kind of go through. You do an overview of the deities and stuff like that, and what happened to the sources that talk about the deities. And you mentioned, and that, I actually want to ask you about the deities here, and kind of see what you have to say about them, because as you mentioned here that a lot of the sources were destroyed. It's really, really hard to come across really good information about the details of the deities. A lot of the Slavic tradition, as well as the Celtic tradition, they're not as blessed as we are in the Germanic tradition, where we have the Eddas and we have a lot of stuff. But you mentioned a document in here, the Book of Veles, which I am not familiar with. Could you tell us about what that is?
Okay, so the legend behind the Book of Veles is, many call it a forgery, but once you begin reading the original, you begin to think that, you know, if somebody would create a forgery, it would be much better written forgery. So basically what it is, it's a book of kin. They just called it the Book of Veles. I don't know why. Because I guess the patron deity for the kin that book belonged to was Veles. But basically, such a book existed in every kin in the past. When I say in the past, a little over a century ago, with communism, everything was destroyed. So this book was written on, well, the legend says that this book was written on wooden planks. Then some soldiers during, I guess, either World War I or Revolution found those planks and took them, hid them, and somebody found them. And first, they did not make copies of them, but they actually just rewrote everything that was written on the planks. And I don't even know if it's in specific order or not. And about 20 years ago, maybe more, maybe even 40 years ago, a certain person, I can't remember his name, started to interpret the Book of Veles. It's written in a Slavic dialect, which is called Velesovica, which is kind of like the language of Veles, I guess. But it's basically a Slavic dialect. And if you know like old Slavic or ancient Slavic, more or less, you can read it freely. And I don't agree with the interpretation per se, but I am very grateful to one Ukrainian author who, the way he published the book, is he provided the original rewrite of those wooden planks. Mm-hmm. So the original runes, one can say. And then side by side in the book, he provided his interpretation. So I don't agree with the interpretation in many different areas, but just because he provided the originals, there's so much hidden in the original runes that it just can't be a forgery, because even those people who published it did not even see what is hidden in the original text. They just provided their interpretation, which is, again, I'm going to say not very accurate. It's maybe about like 70 or 80% accurate. But they did not see that it's hidden in there that the earth is flat. At least the plane we live on is flat, with the sun revolving around our heads in a circle. And I actually had a debate one time with a guy who read the Book of Veles, and I told him that. And he's like, no, you lie. So I had a copy at my father's house. I went back. I took a photocopy of the page. I circled where it's written in runes about the sun circling above our heads in a circle. And I sent it to him. And I've never heard from him again, because apparently he only read the interpretation. He didn't really pay attention to the runes. Well, most people wouldn't. The same goes with any religious text or any ancient text. People try to take the easy way out. They read the interpretation by somebody who already read it, but they never ask for the original. And if they ask for the original, and original is in a different language, again, they ask for interpretation instead of trying to learn that language in which original is written. So it's just,
I was going to say, Dimitri, we actually have a similar book in the Germanic lore. It's called the Orlinda. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book.
I'm not familiar, but as I said, such books were present in every kin. They were just destroyed by huge numbers. So basically, any house you could walk into would have such a book.
And this book specifically talked about the Frisian people. And for those who don't know, the Frisian people are the northern part of the Netherlands. They speak a actual language called Frisian that's basically Dutch and English, you know, kind of combined. If you understand Dutch and you understand German, you can almost pretty much understand this language. And it's very similar to Anglo-Saxon, to be quite honest. So it's very interesting. They actually had a runic inscription, and there's a deciphering code in the book. And it was supposedly carried on by some families. Very interesting history around it. Of course, you know, mainstream academia says that this is a fraud. It's, you know, not real. But at the same time, there's so much information in there that you can't discredit it, especially the information around the gods and stuff, the way they describe them in the Orlinda. You almost kind of get a grasp that even if it was a forgery, it was probably an interpretation of a real myth.
Yeah. Orlinda book actually outlines a land called Atland, which a lot of people believe to be Atlantis. So that's pretty fascinating stuff. And I see some more people coming in if you guys are tuning in. I'm Big Dave Martell. Welcome to the Bog. With me tonight is Dimitri Kushner, author of Slavic Paganism for Beginners, as well as many, many other titles, such as The Slavic Way and quite a few others. And then Riding Shotgun with me is The Folkish Farmer. Now, and also, everybody, make sure to stay tuned. The Epicist Magazine, Issue 2, is up on the screen there, is going to be dropping in the next couple days. Epicist Magazine, number 2. Stay tuned. It's going to be really, really great. You guys are going to absolutely love it. But anyway, so back to the Book of Veles, and I wanted to touch on one more thing about the Book of Veles before we move on. You mentioned, it says, is in your deity chapter, the Book of Veles, which is a journal that was supposedly written within one kin over a period of 20,000 to 100,000 years, with the last entry dating approximately 1,000 years ago. So, Dimitri, I'm sure you're aware that flies in the face of all accepted, you know, archaeology and time periods and documentation of human migrations and civilization and everything like that. What do you say to those people that are like, how could it have been written 20 to 100,000 years ago?
Well, you said the key word, all of the accepted. So there's definitely going to be a lot that were not accepted into traditional history. But everybody who says anything in regards to official history, I say, you know, there's a really good book called Forbidden Archaeology. Spend the money, buy it, read it. It's going to blow your mind. And that's that.
Very cool. So Forbidden Archaeology, it's called.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on, I did want to touch on one more thing in your chapter about deities. And this is something I found kind of interesting. Now, I'm assuming there's going to be more of this in Book 2, talking about the descriptions of the deities. You kind of just, in this chapter, you name them and say that there are many gods, and then you kind of move on and stuff like that. But I'm guessing you're going to flesh that out more in a later book, or perhaps you already have in one of your other books. But you mentioned a few of these deities, and to somebody like, you know, like me, that I'm very familiar with Germanic, and you know, obviously being a Germanic heathen, being Sedian, I see some Germanic names in here. You have Odin and you have Tyr, and then also you have Vishen, which you say is cognate or is identical to Vishnu, and I'm not familiar with some of these other deities. Could you tell us a little bit why you have Germanic deities listed in here? Are they listed in the Book of Veles, or is that was that a common thing among Slavic people to also have Germanic gods in their pantheon?
Well, this goes back to my conversations with many Celts and with many Germanic pagans. Usually takes some time, but eventually we come to the realization that some time ago, maybe it was centuries, maybe it was millennia, but we all belong to the same kin, just somewhere along in the timeline. We split into different branches, but we all believe in the same principles, and we all have similar holidays, similar celebrations. We follow similar calendars. So eventually you come to realization that, you know, we have one ancestor sometime really long time ago. But just as two brothers eventually leave the family home and begin their own lives, same happened with us. I mean, we all went separate ways, began our lives, but we did keep, even if not by a lot, not, we kept to tradition. And I mean, I don't know if you talk to Celtic God on your show, but me and him had lots of conversations, especially actually in regards to even Tyr. But yeah, we eventually come to a realization, you know, we're, even though distant, we're brothers. And if I was to find myself in a fight, I'd much rather to have somebody like him by my side than somebody who claims to be my brother but has no genetic relationship to me.
Yeah, actually, I'm friends with another YouTuber named Celtic Tiger, and he actually did. I did a really, really great interview with him on the Bog like a year ago or something like that. He really dug into the Celtic sources, and we talked. And there's so many, you know, things that were like, "Wow, that's the same for me." Yeah, oh. It was pretty incredible. So I agree with that. And I think, you know, a lot of this stems from the Indo-European kind of thing. You know, my buddies, you know, my co-host Tristan, who's not here tonight, and then some of his colleagues over at the Ari Akasha Institute dig directly into the Indo-European, you know, correlations, the cognates. And that's what they do. That's what they do for a living. And some of the stuff that they dig up is truly mind-blowing. How much connections and parallels and how much identical stuff is not just between the European traditions, like, you know, between Slavics and Germanics and, you know, even Mediterranean and Celtic, but also in Hinduism. It's like all the same stuff. And they even find stuff in East Asian traditions that are the same thing. So it's pretty incredible how much sway and how much influence the Indo-Europeans had as far as spiritual tradition. But I'm going to ask you about a couple of these deities, and then I want to move on. I have too many questions for you tonight. I want to stuff it all into the hour. So who is Rod?
That's the rough translation is kin. So it's all of the ancestors who came before you portrayed as one supreme deity.
So Rod is kind of like the overarching divinity.
Yes.
Would Rod be sort of like how the Vaishnavas in Hinduism call, what do they call it? Brahmana or whatever, the overarching, like the over God?
You know, I'd say probably. I'm not too familiar with Hinduism in that regard. I just can tell you, and believe me, how many debates I had with those guys, which I usually end within 30 seconds, but everything they have came from us just really long time ago. They're basically the keepers of our ancestral wisdom because we knew, well, our ancestors knew we would lose it sometime along the way. So everything they have is actually ours. They just put their own spin on it.
Dimitri, there was a Russian guy, and I cannot A, pronounce his name, nor B, remember it, but he proposed a theory that essentially said that the Aryan invasion was in reverse. Do you understand where I'm coming from? In other words, that the Indian people got their culture, their religion, everything from a northern person as opposed to the other way around, as kind of they describe it. Do you?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are even dates in Slavic heritage when that invasion happened. There were actually two campaigns, so technically two invasions, approximately 5,000 years ago.
That's incredible.
And what were those, just curious, what were those invasions called? Did they, is there a name that we could look those up and...
No name, just a military campaign from the north to the south to India. And they happened approximately 500 years apart.
That's interesting. So, and you know, we're kind of making some connections in Nerona society that are really, really fascinating, that kind of fly in the face of the timeline that is accepted. I'm not going to dig too far into it because it's just kind of like a theory right now. We can't really verify it or whatever, but there's a lot of theories that the Eddas are pointing towards, you know, some happenings that happened, you know, in the Stone Age and stuff like that, which completely flies in the face. If there's stuff in the Eddas that comes from the Stone Age, then it's, you know, the Indo-European invasion theory kind of loses a little bit of credence, and it kind of sounds like a Germanic invasion theory. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of stuff that can go into that. So I'm going to ask you about a couple more Slavic deities, and then we're going to move on here. So who is Svarog?
Svarog is like the all-father of the deities. So he is the son of Rod, but he is the father of all Slavic deities. So he basically created our existence.
He's the sky father.
Yes.
Very cool. And I'm guessing Perun is his son?
Yes.
And Mother Sva is his wife?
Mother Sva is actually like very interesting because technically like Makosh is his wife. And I believe Vlada is his wife. But see, you don't really look at, you don't try to give deities human personification that far, because you still have to realize and understand that they're not human. They are just energies that are mixing. And once you mix two energies, you get another third new energy. And those are the children of the deities.
So you believe in real divinities?
Of course.
Very cool. Because I know a lot of people call themselves pagan, will try to argue that there's no such thing as actual gods. They're just representations of nature, or they're just,
yeah, that's the easy way out.
Well, yeah, why do you guys think that there's so much hanky panky that goes on through, you know, the Eddas? You know, when you read those you know, old poems, there's some, you know, hanky panky going on there. It does make them look more human because humans do these things, hanky panky, right? So what do you guys have to say to that? Because we do have a historical record of, you know, our gods doing these things.
Well, also you have to keep in mind that Eddas, at least from what I heard, they were corrupt, because you have to consider how many times they were rewritten. And they were corrupt with the purpose of sort of putting down the Nordic race, because Eddas make all of the northern deities look like womanizers and whores and drunks.
Well, not exactly. I mean, when you, at least, you know, when you think about it, yes, some of the Eddas and stuff put down Thor, and Thor would have been the common man's god, but you have to look that it was, you know, written in Skaldic poetry, and that would have been a higher class of people that could actually read and write. Most of Thor's worshippers couldn't probably read and write, to be quite honest with you.
And also there's a big difference between the prose and the poetic Edda.
This is correct, too, and that was the point I was getting ready to make. Thank you, Dave. That, you know, we still have, even the prose Edda, this hanky-panky going on. And there's no reason to, I mean, Snorri himself basically quotes this for his Skaldic poetry. And that's, in my opinion, what he was trying to preserve was his culture and Skaldic poetry and written texts. And just so happened these gods were part of it. I mean, that's, you know, my personal kind of opinion as to why he wrote what he did. I don't think he had any intention of, you know, preserving you know, an old religion or anything. I don't think it was a closet pagan or something. But when you look and you understand the fact that these things were going on with our gods, this hanky panky, you kind of, you know, you kind of take a step back and say, well, maybe they, even though they are divine, yes, they are the divinity and so on, they have the same problems and the same strife we do, you know?
Well, I would also, for a lot of people, a lot of people are outside the Germanosphere. They just hear the Eddas and they think that it's just one document, the Eddas. You have the prose Eddas, which were like a revisioning by Snorri Sturluson, who was he was a Christian monk and he wrote it down and stuff like that. But there's also what is called the poetic Edda, which comes from a book called the Konungsbook, which means the king's book. And this book was found, I believe, in the it was in the 13th century. This book was literally just uncovered in somebody's barn, and it was in Latin. However, the language, it was with Latin characters, but the language that it was written in was called a language called Dangstunga, which was a proto-Germanic, or not proto-Germanic, but it was a Norse tongue that was spoken like around, it's like an old Norse tongue that stopped being spoken around 900 AD, and it goes all the way back to like 400 AD, and that's what the language was written in. So this was a text that was, you know, written or at least copied from a text that, you know, was came from a time period where people were still entirely still pagan. It is, through comparative research, we have verified that the Poetic Edda is indeed an authentic heathen text. It is not a, you know, this contaminated Christian propaganda piece that some, you know, really lazy scholars will try to argue, and that they unfortunately are allowed to promote, and it gets into people's heads and they think, oh, well, I'm not going to read the Eddas because that's Christian contamination, when in fact it is an authentic heathen document. And there are stories in there that coincide with the Rig Veda, that coincide with other traditions all throughout, you know, Indo-European traditions. You know what I mean? So enough about the Eddas. We're going to talk about, I'm sorry, you had something to say?
Well, just one last thing. Even the, I think it's pronounced Delcarlian runes were actually written all the way up into the 20th century. And people forget that too, when you want to talk about carrying on these traditions. So, you know, runes went out of fashion in what, the 10th, 11th century?
Yeah.
There's a part of Sweden all the way up into the 20th century that carried on writing in runes. And, you know, it's a dialect of Swedish. You know, only a couple thousand people still speak it. But over their houses and stuff like that, they actually still write things in runes. So for a story to carry over, like we're talking, it's very possible that that could have come from the Stone Ages. You know, why not? It's continued up into the 20th century, and that specific just one little thing of writing died out hundreds of years all around them. And now, you know, it's finally dead there, but it's still even carried on in, you know, little festivals and stuff like that. So why couldn't you have a story that carried from the Stone Ages all the way through? And back to, you know, kind of what I was saying with the hanky-panky and stuff like that, the notion that our gods were omnipotent, omnipotent, and all of that never crossed our people's minds. It never did. And I don't think that crossed in the Slavic people's minds. There's no god that's omnipotent, omnipotent, you know, like a Christian god is.
No. So
not really, no.
And also we have to remember that a lot of these the stories of the gods are indeed to be taken in different ways. Like, they could be representative of ritual, they could be moral stories, they could be transformative, they could be literary device, they could be, there's so many ways to interpret and understand and decode. The ancient texts are a lot of like mysteries and stuff like that, so.
Yeah, and that's the skaldic poetry. I mean, that was the point. It was supposed to have 8, 9, 10 different levels of meaning.
Yeah.
That was the point of the poetry. So it's really cool. It's like a riddle, you know?
Yeah, it's really, really, it's a relic. It's such a, you know, a treasure that we have these documents. But anyway, let's move on. Now, Mr. Dimitri, this was chapter 3 was a chapter that I had some disagreements with. So I'm gonna ask you a couple questions about this here. It's how to worship the deities. Now, your position is that there's no such thing as worship, but I kind of feel that your use of the term worship is a little bit of a semantic argument. Why do you say we don't worship?
Well, because worshiping it makes it a religion, and paganism is not really a religion. Religion is something that's created by man in order to control other men. That's why they say fall to your knees. That shows obedience, that shows control.
So what if somebody wanted to get on their knees just for their deity, not for any other man?
I'd say, you know, it's a good Christian you have there.
But what if they're not Christian? What if they're, we have tons of evidence that our ancestors did get on their knees in worship.
What about the Buddhists as well? I mean, they're constantly in, I think it's called Seizan, which is on their knees and, you know, meditative position. And they don't even, I mean, technically believe in gods, you know, or a god. And, you know, they're on their knees as well. So the whole concept of worship here, when you look at it, is, you know, surrendering yourself, I think. And a lot of people have mixed this up with just Christian values or the Abrahamic, as I would say, because like Islam, surrender and so on. I don't see when I, you know, do a sacrifice or a bloat or something that's anything like a Christian value, but it is still worshiping, like you say, Dave.
The way I see it, and again, that's just me, you wouldn't see, I see my ancestors and my deities as my family. And have you ever stood on your knees before somebody? You know, it's uncomfortable. So why would you do something that is uncomfortable to you before your family that actually really, if you think about it, it belittles them because their descendants who are supposed to consider themselves great, who the parents did everything for so they would be great, they would be honorable.
So if we had a really, really great beloved king that was the greatest leader that we have ever seen, he walked into a room, you wouldn't bow?
Of course not.
Why not?
I would stand on evens. Because who made him king? Did he make himself king, or did
if it's by their deeds and by their honors, would you not respect that? That's what bowing would be to me. I respect, you know, what you have done, your accomplishments. Yeah, I wouldn't bow to him if he's some, you know, I guess I can cuss here, piece of shit congressman. But, you know, if it was a king that I respected who, you know, took care of the land and took care of me and my family and my people, yes, I would bow to him. I would have no problem with it.
But you know the actual ritual behind bowing? You know what that is?
Let's hear it.
Well, I mean, you've got it from the Japanese culture, I.
Yeah, but you know the ritual behind it?
No, I do not.
It's the release of negative energies towards the person you're bowing towards. So every time somebody bows to you, they are releasing all of their negative energies onto you. That's why it says it is customary when somebody, even as little as bows their chin, like bows their head just a little bit in your direction, it is customary to bow back. Because if you don't, you are accepting all of their negative energies.
So we have a custom here in the South, and I don't even know if Big Dave knows this, but like when we're driving in a car, right, rather than waving your hand out the window, we actually nod our heads at each other. And it's a very strange little thing. I only see it in the South. So I'm not trying to direct a negative energy toward him. I'm just acknowledging him as my neighbor as we're passing. I don't know if I understand how that
he acknowledges you back. And when that is done, those energies destroy each other. But if he doesn't acknowledge you back, then?
If two bad energies hit each other, if both people bowed, then that would be a good thing, right?
Yes, but see, if the king is walking down a pathway and you have thousands of people bowing to him and he does not bow back to them, guess what happens to the king? His rule is not going to be a long one or a happy one.
So what if it's a different motion entirely? Say it's say something that doesn't let's use something fictional. Say in this fictional world, your show of reverence and respect is to put your hands on your face, or just nod your head, or turn around behind, or something. It's just an action of showing reverence. Do you have an opposition to that?
You know what? Ritual was always present among pagans because they all consider themselves and their deities family.
What's that?
Hugging. When you hug somebody, you exchange positive energies. There is no negativity involved. You wouldn't hug a person you hate.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think about this like, you know, if I'm at the bar or something and somebody that I've met comes up, we hug each other, right? You know, I know it's common in some cultures to, you know, kiss on the cheek and things like that. I certainly, you know, did that when I lived in Europe with the ladies and stuff like that. But there is a more intimate form of greeting by hugging. I certainly understand that. But, I do want to, you know, go back to what Dave was saying. If there's an acknowledgement back, you know, if the king nodded back at you as you bowed, would that not be kind of a negating force?
No, if it's a mutual bow, that's why they have it in Japanese culture. And actually, Japanese culture took a lot from old Slavic culture. If it's a mutual bow, then again, the energies are not exchanged. The negative energies that are released, they destroy each other.
So what do you what's your take on all of the different depictions we have of people bowing and kneeling and doing all that stuff before effigies of the deities? You know, I mean, there's quite a few. I actually just saw one. It was a black and white picture of a guy in Finland that was in the 1800s where Christianity didn't quite reach, and they're still doing their kind of regional pagan practices. And he's before an effigy of one of the Finnish gods, and he's on his knees offering like a bowl of milk or something like that. What do you think about that? There's, you know, statues from the Bronze Age. We have depictions in Mediterranean culture. We have depictions and effigies and statues and evidence all over the place of ancient people.
Yeah, and you have this also.
The question that usually comes to mind is who created that evidence and when. And Christianity is not the only religion. I mean, you have to realize that religion has been used as a weapon for millennia. Christianity is the religion that actually succeeded in creating obedient slaves. But religion was used as a weapon for millennia, even for millennia before Christianity.
Now, you know, before we start running out of time, I want to hit you with one more debate question, and then I want to move on to a couple other things in your book.
You want to talk about the coronavirus?
Yeah, we want to talk. We'll do a couple minutes on coronavirus at the end here. I really wanted to dig into as much of your book as possible, but this was one discrepancy that I kind of found a little bit. I was like, you know, this kind of I wanted to ask you about is you say at the kind of in the middle of chapter three, you say in the case with Slavic paganism, and in parentheses you say which is not a religion at all since there is no set of rules in place to follow. And then you go on in chapter 12 to say what is forbidden in Slavic paganism, and then you list some rules.
Forbidden by the tribal council for the most part.
Wouldn't they be rules, though?
I did say in the book that a Slavic pagan would never really sin. I also did say that.
You said there are only a few very general rules. Honor thy ancestors,
yes,
and deities. Follow thy conscience.
Yes.
Live in harmony with Mother Nature.
These are the rules that have always been in place. But they're, again, I use the word rule because the word that I wanted to use is non-existent. Another word is guidelines. But you're not punished for breaking them. It's not a rule that you will be scolded or punished or imprisoned, or you're not punished for breaking them because you are punished by your conscience. You will be exiled, but it's one of those things that I do touch on it in book two. Exile is usually a thing when if you don't want to live in our community and be like us, you're welcome to go and live somewhere else.
No, I agree. I agree with that completely. But I would consider those rules. You know what I'm saying?
Again, there were no prisons in old Slavic lands, and nobody was punished like people are punished today. So, like, let's say, take any rule today. If you break it, there is a form of punishment in place. Same can be said about any religious text of any religion. Beside rules, there's usually written a punishment that is suitable for breaking those rules. I mean, read Talmud, for example. They even state like which rules if broken receive death punishment.
Well,
the Talmud's a whole different ball game because they take a rule and then like five or six rabbis debate the rule, give their opinions, and then like five or six more. So there's like 100 pages. And I don't know if you guys have seen the Talmud, but I mean, it'll fill literally a whole bookshelf is how big this compendium is when you take all of the, you know, from the Babylonian all the way through Talmud. So that thing is absolutely crazy. We don't have anything, nor should we even kind of compare it to Germanic religions because of the way the debate structure is in the Talmud. I mean, it's completely like foreign to even my thought process to this day, how somebody could argue so much over one thing and then not really give a decision, but kind of give a decision on it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
And real quick, actually, shout out to Christopher Waffen for donating one ice cream. Thank you for the ice cream, sir.
I will bring one, because I often actually refer to them, I do refer as guidelines or guiding principles, but I will bring up one, and because I had a lot of debates regarding this one, even in my on my Slavic channel on YouTube, but respecting Mother Nature.
That's a rule, though, right?
It's a guiding principle. So Slavic paganism has it. Name one religion that tells you to protect nature.
Well,
the Shinto religion. The Shinto religion is extremely huge on protecting small trees and shrines and things that are in nature. So I would give you an example of Shinto that's telling, you know, people to do that. You also,
okay, I will go with that because I did read about that too.
Yeah, that is an odd. So I'm going to say that I threw you a curveball. So, but yes, outside of Shinto, I don't know of any other religion that says that.
Because Christians hate me for this because I tell them that I'm like, well, when Christianity was written, nature did not need protecting. I'm like, well, Slavic paganism existed eons before Christianity, and we always had that guiding principle. You have to protect Mother Nature because if you don't, you die.
Okay, so moving on real quick. We're starting to run out of time a little bit here, but I kind of wanted to get on chapter 5, which is probably my favorite chapter in the whole book because you smash a... Here's the thing. This is what I like about Dimitri. He has some, like we're talking about here with rules and kneeling and stuff like that, that I big time disagree with. And then he'll go on to smash something that the New Agers love and piss them off. So Dimitri has a pretty good handle on triggering everybody. I think he described it.
Yes, I do.
Oh, I'm ready to hear this crashing the New Agers. Yeah. Let's do it.
So chapter 5, he says, how can a piece of wood be a deity? And then he goes through how, and he pretty much just smashes materialism. And he says, no, a piece of wood is not a deity. It is a representation of a deity. And the gods are divine. They're not pieces of wood. We just make the pieces of wood to represent them and go on with all that stuff. Could you give us an overview of this chapter a little bit and why you felt it was important to put it in here?
Well, the reason I put that in there is because that's number one argument I get from the Christians. And usually my rebuttal is because they tell me that, well, you pagans, you worship pieces of wood, you worship wooden dildos. things like that. And I'm
who makes dildos out of wood?
Yeah, and I just turn around and I tell them, like, hey, you guys worship a corpse on a stick. And yeah, usually they get all pissed off at me for that. But it's important for people to realize that paganism is not a religion. You don't have to do anything except to follow your own heart. And your heart will usually guide you through. Unless you're a psychopath, then you probably can't be a pagan per se at all. But
so what would you say to guys? So what you're describing is that paganism is essentially just kind of like the default position, right?
Yes, it's something that has always existed, something that is present within our DNA. So like if we could access genetic memory, we would learn that, you know, it's always been there. That's where we come from. We are children of the deities. And we talked about that before. Mm-hmm. So it's not religion. Because religions are usually based on rules to control what people do. And actually, by reading rules of religion, you can even say how morally sound the people who follow those religions are. So if there's like, I mean, I'm going to say some profanities right now, but like if there's a thing in religion that says, a rule in religion that says, don't fuck goats, you know, somebody did that. Yeah. In order for that rule to be placed in there.
Yeah. I mean, you're being kind of Islamophobic right now, so.
I thought I was talking about Christianity.
Oh, no. Oh yeah. Well, so here's the thing. Okay, so what, okay, here's the question that I have for you. So what would you say to people that do practice a form of paganism that is a little bit more codified and they want rules and they want a religion and stuff like that, kind of like, you know, what the Hindus do or what the Buddhists do or something like that? Do you think that they're kind of going against paganism? Do you think that religion with rules can be good? What do you say? Because what do you say about that?
Now, I think they're just haven't found themselves yet, basically. So they're kind of like in comatose state. They need rules to follow. Otherwise, they don't know where they are or who they are. So, you know, maybe they'll awaken. Maybe they won't. I don't know. Every person is different.
But do you think that there are cases where pagans that instill rules and have principles and codify and quantify and develop more sophisticated kind of areas of philosophy and stuff, do you think that there's a time where that can be beneficial?
No. Because you're still you're trying to control somebody else. And that's not what paganism is about. Paganism is about self-development. It's about bettering yourself, not trying to better somebody else.
So we have a pretty much universal prohibition against murder. And I'm not saying like enemies coming at my gate and I kill them. That's not murder. That's me defending my family and my tribe or whatever. I'm talking about like, Dimitri, you and I just didn't get along and I slit your throat or you slit my throat. That's murder, right?
I know exactly where you're going. I know exactly where you're going.
So yeah, I would kind of want you to clarify, I guess, moral society values, and then what I guess Dave and I are saying is religious values.
Okay, I will actually talk about murder because it's a really cool topic to talk about. So
well, not really, but
nice try,
a really
FBI.
Cool topic to talk about. it's an awesome topic to talk about. So actually, let's talk about murder and suicide, because most religions do have something against suicide. So what do we know about life? Well, in paganism, it is said that it takes an enormous amount of energy to create life, mm-hmm. and even greater amount of energy to create human life. And it's human life is not created just by two parents. It's also created by the involvement of all ancestors and several deities. So, I mean, it takes a lot of energy to create just one single human life. But murder is easy, especially in our age. I mean, you pull a trigger, the projectile flies out of a barrel and you have a murder.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you don't even need a rule against that. You just need to say what awaits people when their time in this, on this world, in this world is up. Deities look down on somebody who disregards and wastes their efforts. So after deities put in all that effort in order to create a life, you took an instant to take that life and end it. How would the deities look upon you when your time has ended in this world?
So my question
that sounds
would
like
be
punishment,
then,
though. That sounds like they're going to go down into getting judged by the gods.
They don't punish you, but you have to remember that in paganism, it's all about experience, in this world. So pagans do believe in reincarnation. But if you kill someone or if you take your own life, so you just show disregard for the energy the deities have put in, guess what? You're going into the back of the line and probably not going to get to reincarnate for a while. And that's actually like, I mean, imagine yourself sitting in a desert. You're not in agony. But you're going to be bored out of your mind for what may seem like an eternity.
Just like a punishment.
Yeah. It's not a punishment. It's just something that you will have to deal with because they're not going to put their energy into you until they have put their energies into those who deserve it more.
So, Dimitri, this excuse me, this kind of flies in the face to me of Valhalla. Valhalla is not somewhere that everyone gets to go to. It's not heaven. It's not, you know, this is where the warriors go to. So I'll give you two examples. One, I'm a Japanese Shintoist and I'm flying my little airplane in 41, when did they invade Pearl Harbor? You know,
41.
Whatever.
41.
So yeah, I'm flying my little airplane and I know if I crash my little airplane in this aircraft carrier, they're not going to be able to scramble their planes and a bunch of my, you know, fellow countrymen live. Guess what I do? I nosedive that damn plane into the aircraft carrier and I take it out. Same thing. I'm standing on a bridge. I got a battle axe. And I say, retreat, guys. I'll hold this bridge. And I hold it for 20 minutes and I die. But all of my, you know, family members, all of my tribesmen, they get on the ship and they are able to make a retreat. Did I not just die in honor?
See, it all goes back to conscience, and it all goes back to actually, were you following your own heart or were you following somebody's command? Because taking a nosedive, you know, somebody had to give you a command to get into that airplane and take a nosedive.
Yeah, but I could have also looked back, the command could have come through, and I could have said, yeah, I'm a chicken shit, and I'm going to dive the other way. Or I could have said, you know what, I'm going to save 12 of my countrymen, and I'm going to nosedive this thing right into that aircraft carrier deck.
Yeah, but
same with me
again,
standing on a bridge.
Once you die, you don't know of the consequences that followed.
So is there consequences?
There has to be a consequence if that's what you're telling me.
There are always consequences, but it's more of you judge yourself because you are presented a picture of your own life. Supposedly, I mean, this is supposedly. I've heard so many different stories from people who came back after clinical death, who came back like after coma. So everything is supposedly, but every action has a reaction. So energy, it never stops. If you create an action, it will have consequences. This is actually going into the laws of karma, because karma follows us not only in this life, but in the next consecutive lives. So like as many lives as you may live after this one, karma may follow you, like good or bad karma, in all those lives.
So sorry, Dave, I know we're running out of time, but one last question to kind of follow up this. So I'm the guy on the bridge. All my tribesmen, they made the ships. You know, I hold them off for 10, 15 minutes, whatever, then I die. It's basically suicide. Do I carry bad it's karma not, or good karma?
Well, technically, it's not suicide because there was a chance, a slight chance you might actually survive that.
No, I'm talking like you run in there and you know, this is
Ball
it.
Flames.
I got like 10, 15 minutes. Yeah, this is it. This is all we got. This is
Dude,
it.
I have heard about people getting shot like 8 times and surviving.
Oh, I've heard of mothers picking up cars when their kids have been run over. I mean, there's an ungodly strength that can come to people through adrenaline or whatever that mechanism is, you know, and, you know, that's, I can't, Dave, can you remember the guy that was on the bridge in England that, like, defended, that's the guy I'm kind of drawing on there, and I cannot remember his name. He might not have even had a name.
I forget. I don't think he had a name. It was like somebody of the something bridge. He was just some guy that rose to the occasion.
Dave, YouTube gives you a limit of, I think, 8 hours. Can we go on for not like hour number two?
We could do a few more minutes, but I do got to get off of here. I got to get my kids in bed, and I got an early day tomorrow. But we could do a few more minutes, and we can wrap this up. Then we can talk a little bit about Corona. And I know a few of the people that are tuning in just got here, so we'll keep going for a couple more minutes. But
okay, so the latest thing that, and believe me, like I actually talked to quite a few people. I don't know if I told you about this, I might have, about the video game concept. Did I talk to you about that too?
Yeah, it's kind of the simulation theory. I mean, I'm roughing your theory there, but yeah, it's more like a simulation theory.
So basically, there's no way to disprove it because it's impossible, at least at our level. But I was talking to a guy who used to be a Christian priest for like 20 years. And I actually started by saying, you know, like, if you can disprove me, I'll be shocked. And he listened and like, he hung up. And then he called me back sometime later. He's like, he said, you know, you actually make quite a bit of sense. So basically, the way I see it, yeah, again, simulation theory, but a little more involved than that. So most of the people who inhabit this world are NPCs. There's not, I mean, most right. people won't even argue with that, because how do you recognize an NPC in any game? Well, because of the cycle the NPC goes through. And every person you can point out on the street follows a specific cycle, at least most of them. Probably out of a million, one will not follow a cycle. So all those people, they're NPCs. What happens in the game when an NPC dies? Nothing. NPC does not have a soul. NPC does not have a memory. NPC usually is reborn in another game and follows the exact same cycle without remembering who he is or who he was in the previous game. With me so far?
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I got totally. Yes.
So, but once in a while, there comes a person, an NPC, who breaks out of all of his cycles. And I've talked about that numerous times. Like I told people, never find yourself in a cycle, because most people do. That's actually what mortgage is. Mortgage is a 30-year cycle. So I tell people, once in a while, a person breaks out of the cycle, and those who play the game, the deities, they see this one individual because they're able to see a wide range of people, and they see this one individual who's doing something that he's not programmed to do. And they're like, you know, let's save that game for that one individual. And from that moment on, that individual becomes a hero of the adventure game. He's no longer an NPC. He is indirectly, not with a joystick or somebody controlling all of his movements, he is indirectly controlled by those overseeing the game. So he becomes a hero of the game, and he's granted a soul. And soul is nothing more than a memory slot or a memory card or hard disk drive, however you want to call it. So if that hero dies in the game, guess what happens? Well, he's reincarnated. He starts anew, but he keeps the memories of his previous game, so he knows who he is. Granted, that is just so that individual in the new game would not cheat because he has all of the knowledge of the previous game, that memory is either hidden or erased, and only once that individual reaches an appropriate level or XP, he's able to access that record.
Yeah, that, so, a lot of people would call this apotheosis. And real quick, shout out to Roy Danton, donated a diamond. Much love, many blessings to you, sir. Hail.
So those individuals, you can say that those are actually humans with souls. They are immortal, not eternal, but immortal, because their game is technically saved. Everybody else is an NPC. They don't have a soul.
Yeah, this a lot of this, you know, real quick, I saw some more people were tuning in. You guys are tuning into The Ball Guy. I'm Big Dave Martell, and with me tonight, I have my co-host, Folkish Farmer, as well as Dmitry Kushner, author of Slavic Paganism for Beginners and the Slavic Way series. And right now we're talking about kind of his apotheosis simulation theory of existence and stuff. Now, Dmitry, some of what you're talking about is consistent with you know, the Germanic tradition. And you know, back on our previous previous topic that we're talking about, just to clarify for a lot of people, the Germanic tradition does have a very stern process of eschatology, which eschatology is like, you know, the journey of the soul, afterlife, stuff like that, reincarnation. We do believe in reincarnation, but we do believe in afterlife as well. We believe that there's a hall of the ancestors where you go until you are chosen for reincarnation. But also there's quite a few other halls you can go to depending on you know, how you are in life. Now, there is the bad place, which is called, the Saxons call it Nithsella. We call it Niflhel, which is a horrible, awful, terrible place where, you know, serpents eat you, and there's like, you know, it's like the worst possible place. Just they load you up with poison, and you just get eaten and devoured, and it's just like a really, you know, terrible place, which is also found in a lot of other traditions, but that's that was a previous topic. On this topic, what we're talking about is kind of like this idea that there are, most people don't have souls. If you read the Rig Thula, which talks about how you know, Rig comes down, which we believe is Heimdall, comes down and creates the castes of men. You know, creates the Jarl caste, which was first by Kone the Kingly, and Kone is actually the root for the word Konung, which is the root for the word king. That's where the word king comes from, is the son of Heimdall, or the son of Rig, who was created the caste of kings and jarls and stuff. And then you have the Karls, who are the free men, and then you have you know, bondy men, who are kind of like renters of land. And then at the bottom of the caste system are what are called thralls. And thralls are essentially what Dmitry is describing as NPCs. And it is widely believed that thralls either have a more simplistic soul complex, or they just don't have souls. They're just meat machines. They're just NPCs.
Most humans alive today.
So, now I'm going to kind of take a step back into what you were previously saying about people not having rules, and how having rules is essentially just a way for man to control other men.
Other men.
So,
oh, yeah.
Don't you think that the NPCs need rules?
NPCs follow a specific program. Whether or not they're following rules, who knows? But again, we're talking here, I'm just saying they follow a specific cycle. And I can easily find a cycle in most humans, because once they step out of their cycle, and I think the term is stepping out of their comfort zone, it actually causes them great physical and psychological pain. So most people actually follow a specific cycle. Now, that cycle can be very short, maybe a day, maybe a week, maybe a month, or very long. We're talking, like I said, mortgage is a 30-year cycle.
Yeah. I absolutely think it's a fascinating theory. And actually, a lot of that, like I said, coincides with the authentic traditions and the eschatology and the belief of soul and stuff like that that we have. Yeah, I did a whole show on the Bog here a couple months ago with Tristan. We talked about all the details of the soul complex as described in the Eddas and across Indo-European traditions and all kinds of. It was a really, really in-depth show, and I implore people that are curious about learning about the nature of the soul and the nature of spirit and the path of afterlife in the Germanic tradition. I really implore people to go check out that episode. We did a lot of work to go into that one. So it's called, I believe it's.
I'm actually so glad you said the word spirit, because soul and spirit are two different things. And spirit is actually the next level in this simulation theory of mine. So basically what the spirit is, I will interrupt you while I have this thought in my head.
Do it.
I said, like, when the person breaks out of the cycle, he becomes a hero. He goes on an adventure, and he is granted a soul. What happens when, like, how does a person gain a spirit, and what is a spirit? Well, in my belief, a spirit is when his game is not saved, like, on a disc or on a memory slot, but he's actually pulled out of the game, because the way to be granted or the way to gain a spirit is actually for a hero to begin to influence the game itself. That's when you're granted the spirit. That's the spirit is the thing that defines the deities. Because, I mean, many religions speak of deities in the form of a spirit. So once you gain a spirit, you become eternal. And at the end of the game, or at the end of your hero's journey, you're actually can be pulled out of the game in order to join the ranks of the divine, the ranks of the deities. And believe it or not, in Slavic tradition, that is what said happened to Odin, because he did not only go on a journey, become a hero, migrated entire kins from Slavic lands to Scandinavia, but he also was able to change the game itself, to change the construct, to change the way people fundamentally think.
So where would, now I'm going to be completely honest with you, I completely disagree with that, and most Germanic pagans will disagree with that Odin was ever a living, you know, person. But, you know, you're more than welcome to your theories and stuff like that, and I welcome hearing people's theories. So,
well, we talked about that. I did say that all deities at one point or another were human, whether they chose to be or whether they sort of ascended from human state. But at one point or another, all deities in one life were human.
So this also kind of goes against the Germanic tradition, which teaches that the gods were manifested first, and then they created man.
Well, it says so in pagan tradition too, but it also says in pagan tradition, or Slavic paganism, that any being can rise, can ascend to the level of a deity.
So, there's some Eastern traditions there. Go ahead, Volkish.
Yeah, I was just going to interject, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's the euphemistic school of thought, where everything had to be essentially like they had to be from Troy, or they had to be from some other great society.
Euhemerism.
And yes, thank you, Dave. And so we know that that was a school of thought, and that was proposed to, you know, the way our gods were, but that's not necessarily the way they were. I mean, Snorri in his prologues even suggests that I think that Thor is from Troy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
and that's not necessarily true. You know, that's a, you know, school of thought. That's what they're trying to make people believe, I guess to say.
Now, to clarify, I think what Dimitri is drawing from, or the sources that he's drawing from, which I'm about to ask him in a second. But the sources that he's drawing from either draw from or the inspiration for, like, the Eastern idea of apotheosis, which is the rising to divinity, which is not something that we recognize in the Germanic tradition. What Volks Farmer's talking about is Euhemerism, which was a style of propaganda used by the church to undeify. That's not a word, but it is now. Undeify the old gods in the face of Christianity. So what they were saying, essentially, and this is what Snorri was saying, and this is why Snorri's work should always be taken with a grain of salt, and anybody that says the gods are people or representations of people, or they came from Asia, you know, a lot of people will say, well, the Aesir, that means that they're from Asia. That's a false cognate. They made that up. And, you know, they also say the gods came from Troy, or the gods came from that, and they weren't actually gods. They were just people. This was a Christian propaganda technique to, you know, paint the gods as they weren't divine. They were people. They were lesser. So a lot of people that, I don't think that's what Dimitri's saying, as I said, but that's what Euhemerism is. Euhemerism is humanizing or having a revision of the history of the gods to make them sound like people, which is a Christian propaganda technique.
Yeah, I will actually agree with that, because Christianity tried to destroy our heritage for many centuries. And that's just one way they do it.
So I'm going to move on to, actually, we got 15 minutes left. So let's do some Corona posting. Does that sound good, Dimitri?
Yeah. Let me just get everybody triggered here. But I did say something very smart today, and it has a direct relation to the coronavirus. So basically, let me ask you a very simple question. But first, let me ask you, have you seen the Batman movie with Christian Bale and Heath Ledger as a Joker?
Sure.
Yes. Okay. It's one of the best ones, actually.
It is the best one.
I'm not even going to argue with that.
No way.
It is. No. Because
which
of the Joker.
Dave, which one's the best? Which one?
Batman Returns
was good.
What the hell is wrong
with
out
of the Jokers, the best Joker is like the newest one. That's the best Joker.
No.
Oh, well, that guy takes the cake. I mean,
Heath Ledger, but if you follow his dialogue, he says a very smart thing. I can't quote him because I don't remember exactly what he says. But basically, if you tell somebody you're going to kill a specific person, it doesn't really affect them. Correct, right?
Sure.
But if you say you're going to blow up a hospital, or if you're going to blow up a school, the entire people go into a panic mode.
Oh, yeah, the whole quote of do that and no one blinks an eye, but if you do that, then, you know, everybody loses their minds or whatever.
And he did do that in the movie. He said he was going to blow up a hospital. He just didn't say which one. So they had to evacuate every single hospital in the city. So let me ask you this question. This is in regards to the current coronavirus situation. How do you get the entire population of a country to place themselves under house arrest?
A disease.
No, yeah, all you have to do is just tell them that if they don't, you will that randomly 5 to 10% of them will die.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. I agree with that sentiment, but we are seeing, like, there's like videos of them loading just like stacks and stacks of coffins into the back of military trucks in Italy, and there's mass graves in Iran, and not just old people, man, just like lots of, they burnt so many bodies in China that there's black rain in Japan. You know what I mean? There's people dying.
I'm very close to the medical community here. I won't say specifically what I do, but let's just say I'm very close. And we've been seeing a run and shortages on things for weeks now. This has been going on longer than the general public has known about. For example, distribution is pretty much already said. We're out. Government agents have already come and spoken to various large medical, dental, and veterinarian distributors. Because remember, veterinarian equipment's the same as what you're going to use with a human. An N95 mask is an N95 mask.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. So they're going to all these distributors and saying, hey, you know, basically we need this for strategic stockpile. So there really
I'm not actually saying that there is no virus. I'm not saying that there is no virus. I'm not saying that people are not dying. I'm just saying that you have to think about the purpose for all this.
Oh, no, that's something that this is where you and I can go down a rabbit hole to hell, basically. I mean, my personal opinion upon this is all about population control. This is all about a government power grab. Now the CDC has a reason to shut down the economy, just like the Department of Defense does, just like the Department of Yahoo and ABC Soup and so on and so forth. And it's just another way deep state entrenches itself to where no government elected official can actually control it.
Yeah, real quick, so, Roy Danton sent another diamond. He says, "Hail Dave. Hope you and your family are safe. Hail to you, Mr. Roy. Thank you so much. Very, very generous guy. And yes, my family is very safe. If you know old Dave, man, I've been stockpiling for weeks. I put out a video like, you know, two, three weeks ago or whatever it was, you know, telling people, hey, man, get ready. And a lot of folks have sent me messages thanking me for putting out that video because now they have backups of food and everything that they need. So, you're very welcome to everybody that sent me messages, and I'm so very happy that I put something out that helped my folk out, and much love to all you guys, man. We're in this together.
So I was actually, believe it or not, Dave, you were talking about this for weeks. I was talking about something like this happening for years, probably like 5 or 6 years. Because, and let's go back to numerology, this has happened before. And we're not talking about a virus, we're not talking about an illness, but we're talking about a complete, and this is something that I actually recently encountered as one of the, you can say like conspiracy theories or just like way out there theories. One guy said it's the reset of the Matrix. So let's look at the past. This happened in, by my count, in 1601. This happened at the end of the 17th century, beginning of the 18th century. This happened at the beginning of the 19th century. A small version of this has happened at the beginning of the 20th century. And guess where we at now? We're right now at the beginning of the 21st century. And of course, it's going to happen.
Dimitri, you have a parallel with this. And I'll echo exactly what you just said with your timeline there, to where you can actually watch stock markets and currencies around the world and watch them nosedive literally like a week or two after whatever has happened. So when the Spanish flu happened, you watched it nosedive, right? And when the 20 stock market crash, which was brought upon by a multitude of things, you've seen, you know, weeks after the pandemic kind of crash. So you don't actually see it in the economic forms until a couple weeks later from date of when it happens. So we're like, right now we're in the eye of a hurricane as far as the economics are concerned about this whole pandemic and flu.
I got an even hotter take. You guys ready to get your minds blown?
Let's hear it, my man.
So listen to this. The 3 grand solar minimums that are on record, the Spore minimum, 1450 to 1550 AD, the Maunder minimum, 1650 to 1700 AD, and the Dalton minimum, 1800 to 1830, have all been marked by a preponderance of pandemics, smallpox, English sweats, plague, and cholera. Every single grand solar minimum has been marked by an outbreak of a pandemic.
And, dude, don't discount those English sweats. That may sound like, you know, some nasty gym terminology. They literally overheated and died, like blew up. Like, it's a nasty, nasty disease. I was looking that up. I think you posted that on the Neurona Society, actually. I think that's where I was digging into it and was looking at that. And I was like, man, I really hope that doesn't rear its ugly head again.
So maybe what Dimitri's talking about is these occurrences of glacial maximums of, you know, or grand solar minimums. As everybody knows, the sunspots have been going down for like a decade. We are headed towards an ice age, and you know all other these minimums that have been recorded have been marked by a plague beforehand or a pandemic.
Yeah, but
beforehand.
They didn't really observe sunspots 500 years ago.
But they observed the grand solar minimums.
So that far back, I mean, meteorology.
I think we've had sunspot measurements for about 400 years. I think now, you know, somebody in the chats may correct me on that, but I think we've had them for a while because you could actually see Venus with like literally a paper plate and like a mirror. You know, like I think that there's something that like was that primitive that we could have measured, you know, the sunspots and solar activity. I could be wrong.
Actually, it's way, way further. In fact, the first, the very, very first recordings of the sunspots were in 28 BC.
Oh, okay. So, yes. Yeah, so my paper plate theory, like if you had it, like there was a way of measuring it very primitively. So, yeah.
Yeah. But the first time for it to like really, really start getting documented and become a thing was in, the early 1600s by a guy named Thomas Harriot.
Okay, so we definitely had that.
The events I'm talking about actually were all, well, most of them were, I guess, man-made. So you're looking at wars, famine, and, I mean, we talked about, did we talk about the nuclear war of the 19th century?
Yes, we did. We did that on the last episode.
Yeah, but when you talk about those things, Dimitri, when you talk about the war and stuff, that is all tied to economics, because how did we get out of the Great Depression? I hate to tell people, it was not the social works programs. It wasn't building dams and cabins on the side of the road. It was us getting our ass ready to go to war. And if you look at any time we have one of these Spanish flus, so right afterwards you got a huge major war, that tends to be what happens, right? So you see an outbreak. This could be caused by, you know, solar minimums. This could be caused by, since, you know, whatever the natural occurrences. You see this outbreak, you see the economy tank, then you see they take us to war, because it's the fastest way to bring the economy back up to the regular standard. And I hate to say it, but I mean, that's just basic economics. Yeah. You're building bombs and airplanes and you're making suits for the troops and you're growing food for the troops and everything. Man, you can stimulate an economy that way. I mean, Adolf Hitler, that was the key to success. He was rebuilding an army under the National Socialist Program, and that's how he was able to build so quickly the economy, is because he employed everybody in the armed services, essentially. Yeah. And when you have a fiat currency like we have, boom, you have a recipe for disaster. So my question is, who are we going to war with?
Yeah, that's pretty, pretty disturbing stuff. Unfortunately, fellas, we are coming to the end here. I do want to give another shout to Roy Danton. Donated 2 diamonds tonight. Christopher, who donated some lemons, and or he donated ice cream. Sorry, guys, I'm still getting used to this DLive donation system and stuff like that. But Roy says, yeah, that really helped me a lot. I also temporarily relocated and am now really safe. Just running a bit low on beer. My man, Roy. So that might be worse than getting the coronavirus, is running out of beer. That's terrible. But
you can't run out of booze during this crisis. Nah. You got to go stock up now, man. You got to get it. Got to get it while it happens. I heard they were looking to close the liquor stores in your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. It's already closed. They're already closed.
Or toilet paper. Got to make sure you have enough toilet paper.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, I got a garden hose. Yeah. I'm good.
Yeah. I call that the Pennsylvania bidet.
Exactly. Yeah.
Redneck bidet. All right, Mr. Dimitri, we're closing it down for tonight, but I'd like to thank you big time for coming on, man. This is, like always, is a fascinating conversation, fun debates, great topics. I always love having you on. And so tell us where they can find the Slavic Paganism for Beginners Book 1, and tell us a little bit about what's coming up next.
All my books are on Amazon. And next one, I actually did say that I am currently working on book 2 of Slavic Paganism for Beginners. So working on that.
Very, very cool. Very cool. And that's available on Amazon. His name is spelled Dmitriykushnir. It's a little bit difficult to spell for us English speakers out here, but Dmitri Kushner. He's got Slavic Paganism for Beginners. Dimitri, I have another one of your books. It's I think it has to. Actually, I have two of your books. I have like book two of The Slavic Way, which I believe is like one of
that one has all the deities that I found for that period in time in it.
And then you have another one that has to do with like mythological creatures or something like that.
Yeah, Creatures of Slavic Myth.
Yes.
That's a fun book.
That's probably my favorite one. I've only read three of your books so far, but out of the three, I like, just because, you know, I love mythology and, you know, actually, I the reason I bought that book is because I was making something for my Dungeons & Dragons campaign, and I wanted to see what you had going on in your side of the world, so that some of the stuff you wrote in there ended up getting fought by my level 12 paladin, so so that was appreciate that. But all of Dimitri's books are very good. I highly recommend all of them. Go check it out. He even has like some fiction and stuff like that in there too. Dimitri does a lot of writing, as he said, well, 47 books or something like that. That's absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Another diamond. Roy says, now proudly flying the AFA flag in his room. Very, very good, Mr. Roy. Very good. Joining the real life community. That's the best. And we're shutting it down for the night, but I'd also like to ask everybody tuning in, click follow, man. Click follow here on DLive. Like, subscribe, share on YouTube. This will be uploaded on YouTube either tonight or tomorrow. I'm not sure when, whenever I feel like doing it. And then you'll follow me on Twitter at Big Dave Martell. You can find me on Facebook for the time being until I get banned again. And make sure you go over to Amazon the next couple days. I will release it. Everybody will know. Keep your eyes peeled on my YouTube channel, and I'll let everybody know when Epicist number 2 is coming out. It's coming out the next couple days for Ostara. You guys are going to love this issue. Blood, sweat, and tears went into this issue. I'm in there. Folkish Farmer's in there. Tristan's in there again. I've got some poetry in there. Tristan's got some poetry in there. William Reeves returns. Keith Osgood returns. Mark's in there with a really big article talking about the calendar and the solar calendar and stuff like that. So, man, it's great stuff. Folkish Farmer has rabbit recipe. I'm not going to tell you everything that's in there, but I implore you. This is going to be great. You guys are going to love it. I guarantee it. Epicist Magazine number 2 coming out very, very soon, next couple days. So keep your eyes peeled for that. Keep your eyes peeled for the next episode of The Bog next week at next Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, like always. Today we went 8. We went a little bit early, but it's okay. So I'll see you guys here next week, 9 p.m. Eastern. Hail the gods. Hail the folk. Hail victory. I'll see you guys next time. Many blessings and much love. And everybody stay safe out there in these trying times, man. Whether it's a bioweapon, whether it's a hoax, I can't tell you what it is. But what I can tell you is this is a time that people need to be safe. People need to be prepared. And people need to make sure they have their family close, man. This is a time that we need community more than ever. This is a time that we need our folk and our family and our loved ones more than ever. We need to look out for each other because people are going to be acting nuts. People are already acting nuts, freaking out, robbing stores, acting like crazy people. We don't need that. We need to keep our people safe. So stay safe out there. Stay healthy. Yeah, they say wash your hands. I don't know if that does anything, but might as well, right? Wash your hands. So I'll see you guys next week. Much love and many blessings. This is Big Dave Martell, Folkish Farmer, Dimitri Kushner. I'll see you guys next week. Hail.